This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on Talk Louisiana, we'll visit with lobbyist Jim Nickel, the former chair and former executive director of the Louisiana Democratic Party. He works with people from all political stripes now as a lobbyist, along with his partner, Bud Corson. He'll talk about what's going on at the state capitol, as well as what's happening in the Beltway, as the partisan divide is quite intense. Jim Nickel, also the spotter for the LSU football team, as the Tigers prepare for their opener in, about a month. It's getting real close. Coach O addressing the Rotary Club today. We'll also hear from Stephen Maitland Lewis, an author, an entrepreneur, lawyer. And he lives in Beverly Hills, but he was a pen pal when he was a young man in London with Louis Armstrong, and he's involved in the Satchmo Superfest, which is taking place in New Orleans this weekend. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill are producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. Locally, it's 297-5633. You can reach us by email, talk@talklouisiana.org. Jim Nickel is with us, the former chair, former executive director of the Louisiana Democratic Party. That was back in the wild and crazy 80s and 90s, yep. And now for the last 17 years, he, along with his partner Bud Corson, have been quite a presence, a potent pair at the Capitol. Bud is a Republican, Jim's a Democrat, and they work with people of all political stripes. And they deal with an environment now where people of different political stripes, if they're lawmakers, they're usually not real friendly to one another. How's that environment changed over the years, Jim?
Well, certainly in Baton Rouge, we've seen it change, I think, in the last 4 to 5 years, maybe 8 years. In Washington, it's been, of course, going on a lot longer. I always point to the reference that I have, and that is a young John Breaux gets elected to the United States House, and he moves to Washington with his young family, and they buy a little house in Annandale, Virginia, and they join the church, and the kids are Boy Scouts, and along comes a guy from Mississippi who's a Republican, John Breaux's a Democrat, named Trent Lott. Trent buys a house in Annandale, joins the church, and kids join the Boy Scouts and the Little League, and you know, next thing you know, their wives are good friends, and so you know, you're serving with people who you know. Your families go to church together, you have birthday parties together, your kids are in Boy Scouts together, they're playing Little League together. So it's hard to call the guy an SOB on the house floor. You're going to dinner at his house that night. And that was a culture, I think, in Washington that existed for a long time. It created bipartisanship. It created friendships. And I think it created an ability to have policy. We passed budgets. We passed appropriations bills. And we functioned as a government. And I think it was because we had personal relationships. Along in the mid-'80s and late-'80s, it became unfashionable to live in Washington. You were attacked if you moved up there. And so now we have congressmen like Congressman Graves. He maintains his family here in Baton Rouge. And Garrett flies back and forth and serves our state very well and his district well. But he's not up there. His wife doesn't know the other congressional wives except maybe 4 or 5 times a year when they get together for an event. So I think we've lost that personal touch that creates, I think, better policy and better government. And that's the way it goes.
Will that ever change?
I don't think so. I mean, I think we've become so poisoned, is probably a strong term, by social media and other venues that allow for people to attack politicians for whatever choices they make, where they live, what they wear, what they do, what they say, obviously. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be very, very difficult. But we're seeing that more and more, I think, in Baton Rouge. There used to be a lot more socialization amongst the legislature, regardless of party, regardless of chamber. You used to have senators hanging out with reps and reps hanging out with senators. And now we're seeing a lot less of that as well. And I think that is the root cause of what's going on. When you're friends with people, when you have a personal relationship with people, I think it's conducive to better policy, whether you're in a company or you're in politics.
And now, well over 90% of the time, you can almost, well, you not almost, you can predict how people in Washington and maybe here, even here in Baton Rouge are going to vote based on their party affiliation. They no longer really weigh the merits of legislation. John Breaux, for example, as you know, loved Bill Clinton, helped get him elected, was a big part of the 1992 campaign, but he voted against him on the Brady Law.
Yep.
And he was not a supporter of George Bush, his predecessor, but he voted for Clarence Thomas to be a Supreme Court justice.
Well, Breaux was a swing vote in the Senate. Mary Landrieu, to some extent, was. Certainly Bennett Johnston was. And so, yeah, I mean, when I worked in Washington for Senator Breaux, he was very busy because both sides of an issue were in his office trying to convince him. And so he became, I think, a better senator and a better public policy developer because he heard from both sides. And I think you're right now. I think I can probably get out a tablet right now and write down how I think our delegation would vote in Washington on a particular issue. I used to read with interest. The Advocate used to put it in the Advocate. Remember how our delegation voted? And it used to be interesting
to
see when.
They still do.
They still do?
Yeah.
Well, I guess I don't look at it anymore because it's all N's and one Y or all
usually,
Y's. Yeah.
That's
so,
why when there's
and
a.
So, yeah, it's just not as fun to me. I kind of like it when it's a little more unpredictable, you know?
Yeah, well, it's not. And in Baton Rouge, quite often, it's the same story. And it's certainly heresy in Louisiana for any lawmaker, Democrat or Republican, if they have ambition to be, quote, anti-gun. Mary Landrieu, for example, she was largely a pro-gun voter, but on two or three issues through the years, she voted the other way, and she got like a D rating by the National Rifle Association, and it probably hurt her.
Oh, no question. I mean, and in Louisiana, the people are very, very protective of the right to own a gun and guns, plural. Most people own more than one, and it does get touchy. I think if you have the opportunity to discuss gun issues in a reasonable manner, in the proper format, with a group of people who are willing to listen, I think there's a way to develop gun policy that doesn't intimidate or scare people. But there's certainly a block of folks out there who have come to the conclusion that the government's going to take their guns. Ironically, gun sales were at their highest during the Obama administration mm-hmm. because they thought he was going to come take their guns away. Look, if you have four or five guns in your home and by some odd, crazy reason the government decided to ban guns, I think they could get them. I don't think having those four or five are going to keep them away. So I think it's a false fear that is perpetuated in order to raise money and in order to get political votes.
All right, 877-217-5757. And Allie Baltazar says there's a caller already on to discuss this 3D gun issue. Mm-hmm. A judge has blocked an attempt to post blueprints for 3D guns. And yesterday, in a teleconference, Senator John Kennedy went into a tirade, and I use that word not judgmental, but it definitely it revved him up about he likes these 3D guns. Allie Baltazar, let's go to Senator Kennedy commenting about his support for these 3D guns.
I think it's very much a Second Amendment issue. There's nothing in the Constitution, in my opinion, that says the gun that you're entitled to own, according to our founders, has to be made of any particular material.
Anybody, essentially, if they have a 3D printer, would be able to print, whether it's all plastic or metal, these firearms, and it wouldn't be regulated by someone doing a background check. It's just if you have a 3D printer. So you're supportive of making these plans, these blueprints, public?
Well, there's some sales of firearms right now that aren't subject to a background check.
But making these plans open to the public would just open up a whole new door of regulation and not knowing who has guns and who doesn't.
We don't know who has guns right now and who doesn't. Well, there are 300 million guns in this country. There are thousands and thousands of guns stolen every year. We don't know who has guns in America. But I know this, they have the right to own a gun, so long as they're not a convicted felon, and they're not convicted of spousal abuse, and the gun can be detected by a metal detector. And all these attorneys general from the liberal left-leaning states, I think they're all revved up with no place to go. I don't think it matters whether the gun is metal or plastic. The laws that we have already passed apply to it, no more and no less.
So you don't
Thank you, Danielle.
If you're asking me, do I think it's a national emergency that guns might be made out of plastic as opposed to metal? The answer is no. I don't think so. And I think that if somebody wants to own a gun made out of paper mache, so long as it complies with the law, that is their right as an American under the Second Amendment. Now, they can't own that gun if it can't be detected by a metal detector. But those laws apply to all guns, whether they're made of metal or plastic or paper mache or Play-Doh. And I think many of these attorneys general, I think they're trying to use this as an excuse to further chip away at the Second Amendment because they don't believe in it. That's their right as Americans. I do believe in it. I think it's an inalienable right.
All right. That's John Kennedy, perhaps showcasing his run for governor. But, Jim, he makes a passionate case for being pro-Second Amendment. In his case, if you want a 3D gun, you have the right as an American to get one if you're a law-abiding citizen.
Well, here's what I think about what he just said and what we're talking about, and I think it's bigger than the 3D gun, and I think it's the reality that we have a number of disruptive technologies that are going on in our society, and nothing that was foreseen by our forefathers, nothing that was foreseen by Congress 10 years ago. The pace of change technologically going on in this country and in this world is beyond anything any of us can comprehend. And when I say the pace, I mean how quickly this is coming at us. And that's why I think government does have a responsibility to look at these technologies, whether it's 3D guns or it's in the hospitality industry with Airbnb or it's in the other Uber and Lyft and all these different things that are coming at us. Government does have a responsibility to look at these things and say, how do we, and I don't want to say manage because I'm not for more government, but how do we regulate and properly allow these technologies to grow to the benefit? Because there's a lot of benefits to technology. There's a lot of benefits to 3D printers. We don't want to shut down the 3D printing industry because of this gun issue. But what I would challenge Senator Kennedy on is how do we come about a policy federally that is responsible? And that response, I think, left that out.
We'll return with Jim Nickel, prominent lobbyist, and as you can hear, quite a commentator about American life, particularly the political world. And we'll go to the phone lines after this timeout. Your number 877-217-5757. Back after this pause on WRKF. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana. Jim Nickel is our guest, the lobbyist, former head of the Democratic Party in Louisiana. That was a while ago, but he is still quite adept at talking about what's important in our world, and he now works with both Republicans and Democrats, and truth be told, because of the composition of the state legislature, he talks a lot more with people from the Republican side of the aisle than he does those from the Democratic side. David in Atlanta. Hi, David. You're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning.
Well, Uncle Earl Long would say, if he were here today, regarding Senator John Kennedy, he's the only man alive who could talk out of both sides of his mouth, whistle, and struck sitting down. What a man. Well, Senator Kennedy was wrong. I've read many an article that these plastic made-at-home 3D guns cannot be detected with a magnetometer, and that's why they are extremely dangerous. He said as long as the guns can be detected, they're legal. Well, they can't be detected. And then he's saying, on the other hand, that the guns are legal, and it's another insult and a disgrace in Louisiana where you have John Kennedy and Landry who's calling for firing squads and hangings to go to the extreme right as much as they can to be elected governor. And I hope they go so far they both go off a political cliff.
All right. Thank you, David, in Atlanta. Jim Nickel.
Yeah, well, look, I'm going to go back to what I said earlier. I think these 3D guns are just another example of technological advances that are coming at us in a way that our government, and particularly when it comes to guns and safety issues, needs to take a look at. Everybody needs to take a deep breath. And to say that it's simply a Second Amendment deal and we can't touch it, I don't think that's the answer. I think the answer is what's going on? How are these guns being made? How are they going to be brought into the marketplace? There needs to be a system. We have one for guns now. These 3D guns should not be exempt from that system.
Thank you, David, in Atlanta. Let's go to Doug on Corsi. You're going to have to push him up in there, I believe, Allie. Doug on Corsi, you are on Talk Louisiana. Can we get him on? Let's see if we can make it happen right now. Let's go. No, I tell you what, I'm going to work on it right here while we talk to Jim, but we're discussing the partisan divide. And John Kennedy, as you know, back in the day when he was elected to the treasurer's office, I think you may have still been involved in the Democratic Party at that time. He
He was a Democrat.
He ran for the U.S. Senate five years later as a Democrat.
Correct. The year
he had an epiphany, though.
Yeah.
Is that epiphany, I can't read his mind, but do you think it's based somewhat on the fact that he knew that in order to succeed in Louisiana statewide, it was much more palatable to be a Republican than a Democrat?
I'm not going to speak for him. He can answer that question for himself. I don't know. Certainly there have been times when the Democratic Party on a national level has made people in the South, particularly in Louisiana, a little uncomfortable, whether it was abortion or guns or some conservative, I mean moderate to conservative issues that affected those folks, and they decided that they were better off in the Republican Party. So he would speak to that, not me. I don't speak for Senator Kennedy. I certainly have seen enough of it over the years that people do switch parties, and that's their right to do so. I kind of started somewhere, and I'm going to finish where I am. So,
877-217-5757. And a few moments ago, I think we lost both Doug on Corsi and Phil on Jefferson, but I think we have our situation squared away here. So if you call us back, we'll get you in with Jim Nickel. Steve Wynum, the former budget director for the state of Louisiana, has written a letter to Senators Kennedy and Cassidy saying, I know you're not a psychiatrist, but he's talking primarily to Kennedy here, but you are an attorney, and I have to ask if it has occurred to you that the President of the United States might actually be mentally ill. If so, would this not be a basis for removal of office under the 25th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution? How much more delusional can he be before it becomes obvious to absolutely everyone that he lives in an alternate reality? And it goes on from there. And this is from Wynum, who used to work with Kennedy for Buddy Romer. What about the president? He has certainly shaken up the world.
Yeah, well, look, I don't think he's done anything that I didn't expect, and I'm not saying that I knew that Donald Trump was going to be this erratic as president. I think this is his style. That's the way he operated as a businessman. I think the way he likes to do things is keep people on their toes and keep them guessing, and that's his operational style. In his position on issues that I have differences with, my greater challenge with President Trump and is his style of leadership, in so much as that I think he is one that likes to divide people, pit people against each other in order to forward an agenda. My preference in leadership, whether it's on a football team or it's in a business or it's in politics, is for someone to be a unifier, to appeal to the best in all of us, and to have us all sort of rally around the same cause and appeal to what we all can do better together. And that's not his style, and that's my greatest difference with him, besides some of the personal indiscretions, which seem to be okay nowadays.
But as you know, back in the Clinton years, you had to deal with that. That was the Lewinsky thing. It was thought that just
well, the, we had Donna Rice before that.
Well,
I mean, but you know, we
well,
had,
that was Gary Hart.
Not Gary Hart, Donna Rice, but
Jennifer Flowers.
Jennifer Flowers, and if I forget the
in
other
fact, one, name. I've heard a story. I didn't hear it from you, but you reminded me of it. Jim and the former president were and still are friends. And didn't you have a meal with him at Antoine's across the street from Jennifer Flowers' place when she was had her little cabaret club in the French Quarter?
It was at Mr. B's, I believe. Yeah, he was a big fan of New Orleans because his mother had gone to nursing school there. And of course, the day that the Jennifer Flowers story broke, he came to Louisiana and was endorsed by a number of people,
like Billy Tozan,
and then he went on to carry Louisiana twice, and so he was always fond of our state. And I will tell you, speaking of bipartisanship, Mike Foster was governor when Bill Clinton was president, and they spoke on a regular basis.
And he invited him to the Capitol.
And he had him at the Capitol. He had a reception for him at the mansion. And Mike Foster, being a businessman, knew that having a relationship with the president was important, and it was to the state's benefit. We had a lot of health care funds and a lot of things worked out because they could talk.
Let's go to the phone lines. Doug on Corsi. Doug, good morning. You're on with Jim Nickel.
Good morning, Jim. And Jim, one of the factors in folks down at the Capitol not being able to work together these days are outside groups that have come here specifically for that purpose. And the recent special session, a Republican senator from Metairie, Senator Martini, was willing to say publicly that this group, Americans for Prosperity, was pressuring the Republicans in the legislature very strongly, do not cooperate with Governor Edwards. And it's one of the reasons things drug on so long. Fortunately, enough of them decided not to listen to them. But obviously what they have as a priority is not something that helps Louisiana.
Well, AFP is present in Louisiana, and then they are present at the Capitol, and they have the right to do that. It's America. You can come down there and lobby and speak on whatever half you want. There was and there is, I mean, a group in the Republican Party who have an idea that they do not want Governor Evers to succeed, and they were going to be against anything he was for, and that's their right as Republicans to do that. So, yes, that partisanship, that sort of it used to be, at least in my experience at the Capitol over 20 years, is they would always fight. And then in the end, John Hinkle was a Republican and, Sammy Nunes was a Democrat. And you can name different names. Jay Darden was a Republican. And they all, at the end of the session, sort of came together and said, okay, let's put down the bats and the sticks, and let's work out Louisiana's budget. Let's make sure LSU's funded. Let's make sure we do what we need to do to move the state forward. We're losing that almost each year now, and they're willing to have these budgets that break down and go into special session and special session, and it's unfortunate.
If it had been Governor Vitter, my guess is that he would have proposed something very similar to what Governor Edwards did and probably would not have had the pushback from the Republican Party.
That's probably a safe prediction. I mean, there's no question we were in a fiscal crisis. We were, when Governor Evers was elected, there was a lot to do. There were a lot of funds that had been raided, scraped, used to balance the budget. They were no longer available. Taxes, the revenue was down. And so, yeah. And look, I think Governor Vitter would have had a little easier time, no question about it.
We're now into August, which means we are 10 months and 11 days, excuse me, 14 months and 11 days, not that close, but still very close to the next governor's primary, October 12th of next year. And we'll talk with Jim Nickel about this and more in another segment with him. 877-217-5757 is your Talk Louisiana number, locally 297-5633, and you can reach us by email, talk@talklouisiana.org. Back after this time out for the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Jim Nickel, prominent lobbyist. The company is Corson Nickel. He and Bud Corson have been doing their thing at the Capitol and beyond for 17 years. But Jim was the executive director and chairman of the Democratic Party back in the 80s and 90s. He started in the 1986 John Brough victory over Hinson Moore in the U.S. Senate election that was won for the ages, and also a former board chair for WRKF. Let's go to Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, gentlemen. Yes, I think we could all agree that Governor Jindal's administration was a disaster and really did a lot of damage to our state, and that was going with the Grover Norquist tax thing, and also writing legislation by that the ALEC group has just goes there and in the House and writes these legislations for the legislators. Other states are having the same problem now because they're having deficits. You have Kansas, North Carolina, and a lot of these red states following the same no-tax policy are having as much trouble as we are.
All right. Well, Jim, there is a motto that many have, that no new taxes, cut as many taxes as possible, and we can cut our way to prosperity. In fact, the aforementioned Senator Kennedy believes we could cut consulting contracts and balance the Louisiana budget.
So here's what I would say about that. Let me ask you a question. Do you think when Mark Emmert hired Nick Saban, that Nick Saban said, I'll take the job and I'll win three SEC championships and a national championship, and I don't want you to do a thing? I don't want you to do anything. That's not what he said. He said, you want to win, Mark? Here's how you're going to win. Mm-hmm. I need a new practice facility. I need a new nutrition center. I need more assistant coaches. I need an academic center, a Cox Academic Center. You want to be great, it costs to be great, right? You want to be excellent, you have to strive to be excellent. You have to have a commitment and a process, as Nick says, to be excellent. So our state, I think, is at that crossroads. What are we going to do? We have almost, if not the most poor people, the most undereducated people, right? We have some of the worst roads, right? We have people who are very unhealthy. And I look, Newsflash, it costs money to fix that. Now, if we don't want to raise taxes to fix it, I'm fine with that. I'm not saying we should have more taxes or less taxes. All I'm saying is our asset, our people out there, are in desperate need. I think this state, the roads and the infrastructure and our universities need investment to be great. And we either make the investment or not. Now, look, we can drink beer and eat crawfish and have a good time. I'm all about that. But if we're going to be great, we better get committed and we better get dedicated to being great. And if you're going to do it like Nick, you're going to have the resources to be that way.
And your three beautiful daughters all went to the University of Alabama.
Well, I mean, look, that's not connected to that. I mean, yeah, all three of my daughters went out of state to school. That was their choice. I gave them a choice of where they wanted to go, and they chose to go there, and they've had a great experience there. They've gotten to be friends with people from Virginia and Birmingham and expanded their worlds. And but look, you can go to LSU, you can go to Nichols, you can go to McNeese, you can go to Southern and do great things. If our state is providing the economic opportunity mm-hmm. to do that. And that's where I think we have to make that decision.
Stephen in New Orleans. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air with Jim Nichol. Stephen?
Good morning.
Yes,
good morning.
Sir.
Good morning.
Oh, I tell you what, Stephen. Stephen's my next guest. Hold tight. Don't go away, but I'm glad you're on early. Let's go to our friend Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Yeah, Mr. Nichol, should we be concerned that elected officials like Billy Tozan look out for their future lobbying jobs while still in office and vote for laws that help drug companies and hurt their own constituents, for example, prohibiting the government from negotiating lower drug prices?
Well, Billy Tozan has been out of office for a long time, so that's water under the bridge. I think there is some concern about policymakers becoming lobbyists. I get that. They certainly, in any fashion, should not be impacting policy while they're in. But for a lot of them, that's all they've done. I mean, John Breaux was in Congress from the age of 27 till he retired. I mean, he wasn't going to go out and be a welder. That's what he knew. That's what he does, and he's good at it. And that was his second career. So, yeah, we have to be very diligent in making sure that current policy is not impacted by those type of dreams and aspirations, but certainly we'll be doing that as in the future.
Dee in Prairieville. Hi, Dee. You're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning.
Dee, good morning.
Yes.
Good morning. I don't think the people of Louisiana really have a problem with taxes being raised to accomplish the things that we need to accomplish. I think what we're a little skittish about is we've raised taxes, but the money doesn't go where it's supposed to go. So I'd like to hear, that addressed.
I'm glad she asked that because that was part of what I when I talk about whether to be great or not, we do have a credibility problem in Louisiana and nationally with government. People don't want to give the government any more money because they don't think they're doing with the money that they said they would do. That was certainly a challenge for a long time in Louisiana. We have these dedicated fees. They would go into a certain purpose, mm-hmm. and then the Jindal administration went in and swept those funds and put them into to areas that they weren't dedicated to. So, and we've had waste in government, we've had corruption in government, and people go, you know what, I don't want to give them another nickel because they're not managing the money they have now. So we have to work on that, and that is the first step, reinstating confidence in government. Part of my problem with some sections of the media is we continue to beat up government. We talk about, even legislators, I tell them that, don't talk about yourself in a negative fashion because then you reinforce the notion that people don't have trust in government. We have to rebuild trust in government before we ask for more money. So Dee's right. I mean, we got to prove ourselves in government before we ask for more, but we got to get there.
Now, when you were head of the Democratic Party, you dealt with the media. That's how Jim and I got to know one another. We were in the same building, and occasionally there is an adversarial relationship just by the nature of the beast. But the president has brought that to a new level.
Yeah, I saw some of that last night.
And
yeah.
He and the publisher of the New York Times had a meeting that was supposed to be secret, but then the president made it public and basically is continuing his mantra that it's fake news, and now is using the term enemy of the people. And the publisher of the Times, the newspaper of record, Mr. Sulzberger, Arthur Sulzberger, says that the president could be inciting violence against journalists. So what do you think about what's going on now between the journalistic community and the people at the highest levels of our government.
Well, I think it's unfortunate, and that's where I talked about his style of leadership. Look, the media has made mistakes, no question about it, and there's certainly an opportunity for some reflection in the media as to how they handle issues, how they report on things, both from Fox to CNN and everybody in between. But what I think a great leader does is he takes the dialogue to a higher level and he talks about how to make it better as opposed to blaming one part of it. And so we have a challenge there, but I will never, ever underestimate the value of a free press and an aggressive media in our democracy. It is absolutely critical, and whether you get on the wrong side of the media, and I've been there, trust me, it ain't fun. It's a very, very critical part of, I think, a healthy democracy, and we have to do everything we can to protect it. We don't need to protect it from itself. It needs to figure out how to do it right, but we definitely have to have it.
877-217-5757 is your number, and Jim Nickel has been through some bruising wars politically, but you decided to go another direction. What prompted you to have an epiphany of sorts?
Well, you know, I'd gotten to a point in my career where it was going to be one of three things. I was either going to run for office, I was going to be a political consultant, which means I would work on campaigns year-round, or get into the governmental relations business. I just blinked on the whole running for office thing. Sometimes I wish I'd have done it. Sometimes I'm glad I didn't. The political consulting business can be a little bit cyclical. There are times when you are working a lot, and there are times when it's kind of down. I found the government relations part to be a little bit more steady, and with three children and a wife, a better overall income reliability. And then I like the fact that Bud and I have a very diverse group of clients. We have, you know, everything from healthcare to veterinarians to technology companies. We do Airbnb. We do Tesla.
You have Tesla?
Yeah, we have Tesla, yeah. And so every day, every minute of my life and Bud's life is a different issue. And so it's fun. And I like to talk about different things. I'm sure it's fun to be the lobbyist for the hospitals or the CPAs, but to me, it's just a lot more fun to be dealing with a different issue almost every hour.
All right. And for the last 9 years, you've been the spotter for the LSU football broadcast, yeah, working with Jim Hawthorne and now Chris
just had Blunt. Lunch with Jim the other day, by the way. He's doing great.
In fact, I saw you having lunch with Jim Hawthorne,
yep.
And he looks great.
Jim's in great shape, and he's very happy and doing well.
But the Tigers, it's the biggest brand in the state of Louisiana, LSU football. Soon you'll be headed to Dallas for the opener against Miami of Florida. That's a big game, isn't it?
It's a big game. It's a better test, I think, than last year's opener, which was BYU. I mean, I think we're going to learn more about the team earlier than we did last year, because Miami, while they lost a lot of people on a very good defense, they're going to be a better challenge. Question marks for LSU are big. I mean, let's talk about the good news. I think the defense will be really, really good, which means you'll be in most games with a good defense. But the question marks are big. Quarterback, do we have an SEC every down running back? I don't think so. We have a group of running backs that are good, but do we – you know, we've been spoiled. I mean, think about it. Geis and Hill and Fournette. I mean, over the last 10 years, LSU's had an all-down SEC running back. We don't have that. So, and I think the O-line, which was a big question mark I'm hearing, is coming together. So we'll see. And a lot of pressure on Ensminger and some pressure on Coach O. The recruiting's going well. But tough schedule. Fourth toughest in the country. And so I think Tiger fans need to be a little bit patient. But there's some signs coming out of the Ponderosa that there could be some really exciting receivers and a really good O-line, and that makes for a big difference.
And both Florida and Georgia are Alabama and Georgia, 1 and 2, they're playing in Tiger Stadium this year.
Well, and look, I think Tiger fans are due to some good home games, and we're going to have some. And then we've got the Lions out of Southeastern coming, got the Bulldogs from Tech coming.
Well, Southeastern's game number 2.
Yep.
877-217-5757 is your number. A few more minutes with Jim Nickel, and then we'll hear from Stephen Maitland Lewis, one of the most fascinating men in the world, after this message. This is Jim Inkster, Ali Baltazar, and Becca Dill are producing. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. In just a moment, we'll hear from Stephen Maitland Lewis. Jim Nickel is wrapping it up with us, and Bill Kelly says Louisiana's been at the bottom since I was born and probably before that, 60 years. To jump to 40th place would really be astounding. How easy would that be? Would it simply be a matter of will on behalf of lawmakers? This seems like something worthwhile to do, and with the right leadership, could be amazing. Does it come down to leadership, or does it really matter?
I think it takes all of us. I mean, and look, legislators, I tell people all the time, the best lobbyist in the building is the constituent, regardless of what you hear in the media. Constituents make impacts on legislators. And if you want something to happen, if we want Louisiana to be better, then you need to communicate to your legislators and to the governor that you want that. And it's not simply, hey, y'all go fix it. Be part of the solution. Add to the dialogue in a positive way. Bring solutions to the table in a positive way, and we can move forward. But simply saying these lawmakers are letting me down, you need to roll up your sleeves and help those lawmakers. They're there to represent you, mm-hmm. but they need help doing it.
Well, thank you, Jim Nickel. Let's do it again soon, and good luck with the football Tigers this fall. Stephen Maitland Lewis is with us, the award-winning author, British attorney, former international investment banker. He's held senior executive positions in London, Kuwait, and on Wall Street prior to moving to Beverly Hills in 1991. And he's in New Orleans, where he also spends a lot of time, for the Sachmo Summerfest. And we've talked with Stephen Maitland Lewis through the years, and it is always a pleasure to visit with him. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Jim. It's very nice to be on your program. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, for those who are unfamiliar, you are a jazz aficionado, and you became a big fan of Louis Armstrong, the Pride of New Orleans, at a young age. What happened in that amazing odyssey that you had with Sachmo?
Well, it was an amazing odyssey. I'm very privileged to have had it. I wrote Louis Armstrong a very childish fan letter when I was about 11 years old, never really expected a reply. And a few weeks later, I did get a reply, a four-page handwritten letter, which I never expected to receive. And it was a lovely letter, and I wrote back to him to thank him for the letter. Then he wrote back to me to thank me for thanking him, and thus began a pen pal exchange. And it included Christmas cards, birthday cards, and God knows what, mm-hmm. right through until he died. And what was incredible, well, there was, prior to him dying, he came to England a couple of times on tours, and I met with him on both occasions, and he couldn't have been more charming and loving, actually. And what was particularly touching, when the Louis Armstrong House Museum opened, and after several years when they analyzed the archives, he had left something like 600 files. I was there one day, and they showed me my file. He had kept letters that I had written to him. It was a very moving experience to see my letters written from the age of 11 up to my early 20s. And, of course, I've kept every letter and communication sure. that he ever sent me.
He died in 1971, so he's been gone now for 47 years, but he is a legend not only here but all over the world for anyone who loves music. And appropriately, in his hometown, we are honoring him. I think this is the 18th year for the Sachmo Summerfest. You're involved with this as well.
Well, I've been coming for the last several years, and it's one of the major events in my calendar. And it's a very lovely event because one gets to see people year after year. And we are united with this common bond of appreciation for Louis Armstrong and his music. And to the extent that I'm involved, my wife and I are small sponsors of the seminars that take place during the three-day event.
Well, it's Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And it's at the old Mint location. And there are some amazing performers who will be on hand for the 3 days, and it is a spectacle that brings a lot of acclaim to New Orleans. We have some great music in New Orleans, and of course the Jazz Fest and the Essence Fest, but this one ranks right up there. And Louis Armstrong never forgot his hometown, did he, Stephen?
He never did, and he talked about it constantly. He wrote about it constantly. It was a very important part of his life. And, of course, he recorded many numbers involving New Orleans. Basin Street Blues, Do You Know What It Means to Miss New Orleans? Way Down Yonder in New Orleans. And his signature tune, When It's Sleepy Time Down South, whilst not mentioning New Orleans by name, certainly was a direct reference to it.
In November of 2010, Stephen, as noted, was named a board trustee for the Louis Armstrong House Museum in New York. And in 2014, Stephen received the Louis Award at the Louis Armstrong House Museum Gala in New York City. This is also a remarkable place, isn't it?
It's a fabulous place. At the moment, the museum is really the contents of the archives are held for the time being at Queen's College. The museum itself is what was Louis Armstrong's home, his home and his garden. And we also, as a result of a bequest from a neighbor, Selma, the museum owns the house next door, which is now used as administrative offices. But the house is today maintained as it was when Louis died. And it's a very, very lovely tribute to maintaining his legacy. And we receive, I don't know how many visits a year from people from all over the world. They come and visit the house, and they see some amazing things. They see, for instance, letters that were sent to Louis Armstrong from fans all over the world, and the envelopes merely were addressed Satchmo, United States of America, and the U.S. Post Office delivered them. Louis Armstrong, New York, and it was delivered.
In this day of email, we've lost the art of letter writing, I think, and it is amazing that any superstar of the magnitude of Louis Armstrong would be reaching out to a 12-year-old kid from another country, but that he did. You noted this continued over 15 years, many, many letters, and he kept them.
And he kept them.
Today, I don't think that would happen.
I don't think that would happen, and I have to say that I was not alone. I'm sure he took the time to write on a regular basis to many, many, many people. This man was quite exceptional. Even if he hadn't have been a virtuoso, he was still a very special human being. He had great humility. The museum is located in quite an ordinary area. But he knew all the neighbors. He knew all the neighbors' children. The ice cream sellers would come by, and they would supply ice cream to all the kids in the area and send to him, Louis, a monthly or a weekly bill. You know, he was just a very special character.
And as a jazz aficionado, you appreciate his music, and he not only could blow that horn, but he had a remarkable voice.
Yeah, and as far as his trumpet playing was concerned, he really was an innovator, in as much as until he came along, there were very few jazz soloists. Most of it was the bands played ensemble. There were a few isolated cases. The original Dixieland Jazz Band had soloists, but Louis took that to the next level. And as far as his singing is concerned, many, many legendary singers, from Sinatra to Billie Holiday, they've all paid tribute to the influence that Louis had on them. And if you consider the impact Sinatra and Billie Holiday have made, you could therefore say that Louis' contribution to 20th century American music, the great American songbook, was second to none.
This weekend at the Satchmo Summerfest in New Orleans, do you have any recommendations?
Yeah, everybody should go, enjoy themselves, and take an umbrella. I'm afraid it might be a necessity. It's certainly worth braving the tempest.
Yeah, well, what's your favorite Louis Armstrong recording?
Oh, you've asked me an impossible question. But it's a very difficult... I love each and every one, but there is one recording that Louis made, Blue Turning Gray Over You. And I tell you, that song, Blue Turning Gray Over You, the tone of his trumpet playing is so beautiful, so exceptional. It never fails to move me to tears. But then I could say, when it's sleepy time down south, you know, I mean, it's impossible to pick the favorite, my favorite. But if I had to choose one to listen to on a desert island, it would be Blue Turning Gray.
Blue Turning Gray Over You. Stephen Maitland Lewis, always a pleasure. And let's keep talking, and hope to see you this weekend at the Satchmo Summerfest in the great city of New Orleans, where Stephen spends a lot of his time. And we'll talk very soon, I'm sure. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Until then, for Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill, thanks for listening to Talk Louisiana, and stay tuned.